and you thought American politics were messed up, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Britain's Labour Party is roiled today.
This morning, we have all now resigned from the Labour Party.
Seven members of Parliament defected in protest over Brexit and charges of anti-Semitism. Plus, in the Philippines, could a name change help ditch the country's colonial past? Not everyone's convinced.
Honestly, most Filipinos have a lot more to worry about than being haunted by the ghost of King Philip.
And in Antarctica, climate researchers recruit seals to gather data for them all year long.
That means that in the winter, when it's minus 40 degrees, pitch dark, we get data from below the sea ice.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. As if the Brexit mess wasn't complicated enough already, things got a little more complex today in the British Parliament. Seven members of the opposition Labour Party resigned from the party and started their own independent group. The seven quit Labour in protest over two things. One, party leader Jeremy Corbyn's handling of Brexit, and two, alleged anti-Semitism within the Labour Party under Corbyn's leadership. The World's Orla Barry is based in London.
These MPs are pretty significant figures within the Labour Party. There's five shadow ministers, as we call them, ministers representative of important offices from the party not in government. And these are key figures who would be well known in the Labour Party.
Well, let's hear from one of these defectors. Her name is Luciana Berger, and she says it was the culture of racism within the Labour Party that drove her to this.
I cannot remain in a party that I have today come to the sickening conclusion is institutionally anti-Semitic. The leadership has willfully and repeatedly failed to address hatred against Jewish people within its ranks.
Now, she's saying that there's racism within the Labour Party. What's she referring to?
From her perspective, it is allegations, I guess, of anti-Semitism. Luciana Berger herself is Jewish, and she has been trolled quite viciously over the years for her religion. She has called repeatedly on the Labour Party to denounce various claims of anti-Semitism. It's an allegation that has been thrown at the Labour Party quite repeatedly over the last number of years. Jeremy Corbyn himself, the leader of the party, very much coming from the left. And I guess when he came in, he would have been seen as quite pro-Palestine. Not to say that that's anti-Semitic, but there were times before he got into the leadership that he invited, for example, members of Hezbollah and Hamas into Parliament. And a lot of these things that happened back then, there was also a mural that he refused to condemn that was seen as anti-Semitic. These kind of events or incidents that he was involved in, he has not condemned them since, and they've tended to follow him. So it is an allegation that sits very uncomfortably with the party, and the party is seen as not having done enough about it and not having condemned anti-Semitism enough.
For Berger, perceived anti-Semitism was the reason she left the party. For others, it was the sense that the Labour Party had failed to lead on Brexit. What is the charge against the Labour Party in terms of its response to Brexit?
Sure. So when the Brexit referendum was being held at the time, the Labour Party campaigned against Brexit and they campaigned for voters to vote to remain within the EU. However, at the time, the feeling was that their campaign was rather lacklustre and Jeremy Corbyn's comments on it were lacklustre. So the suspicion has always dogged him that Jeremy Corbyn is not very fond of Europe and that he's quite happy for the UK to be out of Europe. Since the Brexit campaign, since the Brexit came in, the Labour Party has been seen as, well, under Jeremy Corbyn, has been seen as being pretty lacklustre when it comes to any fight back against it. Theresa May in the Houses of Parliament, he wasn't seen as taking a tough enough stance against her or indeed her Brexit deal. Many members of his own party, including, interestingly, the seven who have stepped away from the party and resigned today, have called for a second referendum. Jeremy Corbyn has always stepped back on that and refused to agree to a second referendum. And most Labour Party supporters would have been anti-Brexit. So it was seen as a betrayal to them, his stance on Brexit over the last number of months and indeed years at this point.
The changes today, will that have any impact on Brexit, how it's carried out, whether there's another referendum, any of that stuff?
Listen, no one has an idea what's going to happen to Brexit. Not only these new independent MPs or indeed the Labour Party, but Theresa May and her own party for that matter. We're at a stage that nobody knows, despite the fact we're, what, 5 weeks, 6 weeks away from when Britain is due to leave Europe and due to leave the EU. They have said that they want a second referendum. There is, however, only seven of them. There is a possibility they will get more people to join their ranks. And in that case, they may get more people to vote in their favour and against whatever Theresa May's next proposal is and whenever the next vote is. What will happen now? Well, nobody knows.
The world's Orla Barry speaking to us from London. Thanks, Orla.
Thanks, Carl.
This weekend, Britain mourned one of its most cherished writers, Andrea Levy. She died of cancer at the age of 62. Levy's books told the stories of the so-called Windrush generation, nearly 500,000 people who moved from the Caribbean to Great Britain after World War II to fill labor shortages. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
It started as a hobby, taken up later in life.
I just started to write by doing sort of evening class and sort of just seeing how it would go.
Andrea Levy followed the advice, write what you know, and what she knew was her family's experience.
The Empire Windrush brings to Britain 500 Jamaicans.
Her father was aboard that ship, the Empire Windrush, the first to bring what became a migration from the Caribbean. Levy's mother soon followed. They were both of mixed ancestry, including African, Scottish, and Jewish.
They just wanted to find better opportunity, and my mum was desperate to leave Jamaica, absolutely desperate.
They started out hopeful, but soon found white Britons treated them differently because of how they looked and spoke. 8 years after they arrived, Levy was born. She grew up in North London, and her family, which never had much money, thought of itself as white.
Right up until, I think, my mum's death, she found it very hard to say that she was a black person. She just couldn't do it.
Levy studied textile design in college and was a costume assistant for theater and TV. At age 26, she had a revelation in a racial awareness session. People were asked to split into white and black groups. Levy went to the white group, but people from the black group said she belonged with them, so she moved. Around the same time, the early 1980s, the manager of a BBC drama told Levy actors didn't want to be dressed by a person of color. Levy said it was the first time she thought of herself as black. She started exploring her identity in a writing class.
That's a revelation that you can have something that relates to you in your life. Once I understood that, and literature is the most fantastic piece of communication you can have.
She got big in 2005 with her fourth book, Small Island. It follows a Jamaican Royal Air Force pilot and his wife and their British landlords before and after World War II. The two couples found that although they were both from small islands, Britain and Jamaica, they saw things very differently. Levy thought the book would more or less flop, like her previous novels. But Small Island won awards, sold more than 1 million copies, and was the basis for a BBC TV series.
You think your white skin make you better than me, don't you? We both finished fighting a war for a better world. We was on the same side.
With her next novel, Levy addressed Britain's slave trading past, a history she said often went unmentioned. British merchants abducted and enslaved an estimated 3 million Africans to work in the colonies.
I went to a conference and there was a young woman who stood up in the conference and she sort of said, you know, how can I be proud of my history when, you know, they were all slaves? As if to be a slave was something to be ashamed of. That actually took my breath away. And I thought that was one of the saddest things I'd ever heard, because there was a history there that's rich and full. It's just that we don't know it. And so I wanted to, I thought, can I make a story that will change her mind?
The novel, The Long Song, was released in 2010. It follows a young woman named July, who works on a Jamaican plantation and has a child by the master. It was also made into a BBC TV series.
Let them say what they like, because I am the bastard child of empire, and I will have my day.
Levy helped drive a discussion about race in Britain and the lasting, painful impact of its empire. A columnist for The Guardian, Gary Young, wrote in his tribute to Levy that she pushed at every level for a fuller, more rounded, more inclusive version of Britain's history. Levy's influence will live on. Small Island is set to premiere as a major stage play this spring. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Nigeria was supposed to hold elections over the weekend, but just hours before the polls were due to open, officials postponed the vote. They said there were problems getting ballots to some parts of the country. Nigerians reacted with anger and frustration. Here's one voter in Lagos.
It is really, really, really disappointed. We don't like it like that.
Now the plan is for the general election to be held next Saturday. The BBC's Tomi Oladipo is in the capital, Abuja.
One of the main issues is people have had to, for example, a lot of people who prefer to vote in their hometowns across the country. So people make the journey right across the country to go and vote. And that means they have to probably go back to where they live and then head back again over the weekend to attempt to vote again. Now, will people do that? Can people be bothered? Can people afford to do it? That's the main problem. And it's not just people who have to travel. I think for people who even have to walk down the road to the polling stations just down the street, are they still interested? Do they believe in this system? That's the main question.
Now, who's competing against whom? What's this election coming down to?
Well, you've got two major candidates who some would say are rather uninspiring candidates, both of them in the 70s, both of them Muslims from the north of the country, both of them have been in government before. Of course, the incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari and then the leader of the opposition party, Atiku Abubakar, who's a former vice president. These are two men who are part of the political elite who have been there for a long time, and I think some Nigerians will see them as one and the same.
Nigeria is a big, powerful country, largest population in Africa. It's, you know, it's a big country, and it's been having elections for decades. What is the problem? Why can't it be organized for an election at this scale?
That's a difficult question because there have been ups and downs. I mean, if you look at the election 4 years ago when President Buhari came into power and actually upstaged the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, a lot of people looked at that and thought this was actually not necessarily the result of it, but the process in which it was held was a step in the right direction. You had an electoral commission that stood its ground despite pressure from the government and went ahead and held solid elections, at least relatively solid elections. And then you have this time when things seem to have gone many steps back. So I think Nigerians not learning their lessons. I think problems with the system as a whole, a lot of the power brokers still meddling in issues. There's a lot to question in the whole system. So I don't think Nigeria has been able to sustain a system that works. And it will take some time as well, because let's remember it was only 1999 when the country made the transition from military to civilian rule. So yes, we can say that Nigeria has struggled to have successful elections over time. But also let's remember, putting it in context, that this is a country that's only just trying to get on its feet and have a solid democracy.
The BBC's Tomi Oladipo is in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Tomi, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
How American pro-gun arguments translate to Brazilian politics. That story is just ahead, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Brazil has one of the highest rates of gun deaths per capita. And yet the country's president just made it easier for Brazilians to buy a gun. And public support for this has grown recently, thanks in part to campaigners who've worked to bring American pro-gun arguments into Brazilian politics. From Rio de Janeiro, Catherine Osborne has our story.
On a Saturday afternoon on the outskirts of Rio, five people are learning how to fire a handgun. We're at a shooting club. A 58-year-old court clerk named Marcio Monteiro takes aim. He says he wanted to learn to shoot because he works in a dangerous part of the city. Anywhere you go, he says, you find well-armed drug traffickers. Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, ran as a tough-on-crime candidate. And in January, he issued a decree making it easier for people like Marcio to get a gun. Under previous rules, there were lengthy background checks if you weren't in the police or military, and you had to demonstrate a need. Brazil's firearm homicide rate is over three times that of the United States, which is already an outlier when it comes to gun violence. Marcio says he doesn't trust Brazil's police to prevent crime. He wants a gun for legitimate defense, he says. And he thinks he should have the right to own one. But in Brazil, the Constitution does not mention a right to bear arms, unlike in the U.S. In 2003, politicians from several parties joined forces here to pass a law making it more difficult for civilians to buy guns. It was part of an arms control trend across Latin America, supported by research showing that fewer guns circulating meant fewer gun deaths. Pro-gun groups campaigned heavily against the legislation, and they relied on arguments made by America's NRA gun lobby and advice from an NRA official who visited Brazil. They lost that battle, but 2 years later, pro-gun groups helped defeat a referendum that would have banned all gun sales. Benê Barbosa is one of Brazil's most influential pro-gun advocates today. I reached him by phone in Sao Paulo. He says he relies on the NRA as a resource for talking points, like, quote, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Barbosa says one of his main influences is American gun rights economist John Lott. He admires Lott's 1998 book, More Guns, Less Crime. But Lott is controversial. His central argument has been repeatedly discredited, including by an arm of the National Academy of Sciences. Barbosa says Lott's ideas still make sense to him. He cites Lott in his own book, published in 2015 to much fanfare on Brazil's growing political right. As Brazil's political left and center were getting weakened by corruption scandals, far-right and pro-gun views were becoming more popular. Bolsonaro and his three sons, all politicians, embodied this worldview. And they've all praised the NRA. One son, Carlos, told supporters in 2017 via Facebook Live about a meeting he had with NRA representatives at a Las Vegas gun convention. They talked about what's happening in politics and culture in Brazil, the younger Bolsonaro said. Where individual liberties are punished. But even as public support for easing restrictions on gun ownership has grown in the past 5 years in Brazil, most Brazilians still oppose it, in part because the arms control law was shown to reduce gun deaths.
In the first 4 years of implementation of the law, we got 12% of reduction in the whole homicides in the country, and it was the first time that we changed the trend of increasing homicides in the country.
This is Melina Riso of the think tank Igarapé Institute. She says after the gun control law put a brake on homicides, they eventually started to rise again, but at a lower rate than before the law. She says the more recent rise in homicides is due to other factors, like the growth of drug trafficking gangs, and that in Brazilian states with serious programs for youth violence prevention, there are fewer murders.
It's not something that we don't know what to do, but we really need commitment from the government and leadership to enforce a policy based in evidence and can show how we can reduce violence in the country.
She says on gun control, the Bolsonaro administration has disregarded that evidence. Bolsonaro says other hardline security measures are on the way, and so Brazilians are gearing up for more debate. For The World, Catherine Osborne, Rio de Janeiro.
Brooklyn-based musician Helado Negro has been trying to make sense of the political debate here in the U.S. since President Trump took office, and you can hear some of that in his new album, This Is How You Smile.
Obsesionado con mi boca, habla sin respirar.
I grew up speaking Spanish and English in my household. I grew up in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Lauderhill area, Miami. And this song you're listening to is País Nublado, and it translates in one way to cloudy country. And I wrote it in 2017, and I felt very exhausted, and maybe a lot of people did, in terms of our climate here in the United States, social political climate, and I felt like there was an urge to respond. Everyone was asking everyone to do something.
And I, having lost my mind, thinking about you.
The lyrics have this ambiguity that there's like this intensity. Everybody wants to know what you're up to. How are you participating? How are you sharing? How are you acting? And I felt like, well, I do want to do all these things, but I know what I can do, and I don't think it's necessary for me to share all the things that I'm doing. It's almost more important for me to take care of the things that I know that are important to me and do them really well without having to use that specificity in my art. And I think the art can be more helpful if it doesn't have that specificity, so it doesn't get pigeonholed for other people who want to experience the work and have their own interpretation for it and use it in their own way.
Music by Roberto Carlos Lange, a.k.a. El Aro Negro, from his new album, This Is How You Smile. Carol Hills, a Chinese-American man has been imprisoned in Iran for more than 2 years. His wife in New Jersey keeps pressing for his release.
My family does not deserve to be caught up in the world politics, and Xi Yue should not be treated as a diplomatic pawn, political pawn.
The case of Princeton scholar Shi Hui Huang, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Right now, at least 4 American citizens and 1 U.S. resident are being detained in Iran. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the Trump administration is doing everything it can to get them released. On that list is Princeton graduate student Shi Hui Huang. He was detained more than 2 years ago while conducting research in Tehran and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. His wife, Hua Chu, continues to press for his release. She spoke recently with The World's Marco Werman.
Hua Chu, thanks for being here. Your husband's case seems to kind of have fallen under the radar. Now, is the Trump administration doing all it can, in your opinion, to secure your husband's release?
They're helping us, but I'm very concerned that there's such an impasse in the Iran-U.S. dialogue and the prospects for resuming a direct talk is still pretty low. The U.S. government set such high bar to engage Iran in a dialogue. But to me, is my husband's situation is a humanitarian situation, is a tragedy, and his release should be treated as a humanitarian necessity. I mean, apart from any political or security talks, or lack of any such talks. My family does not deserve to be caught up in the world politics, and Xi Yue should not be treated as a diplomatic pawn, a political pawn.
Now, I know you're organizing a call to action. What exactly are you doing?
We're mounting a national campaign. We're calling upon other universities to join our campaign to show support to Xi Yue Huang and raise awareness of the plight of him and the toes we're going through, I mean, as a family. And as of today, Yale and the University of Washington have confirmed they will hold satellite events later this month. And on Wednesday, February 20th, Princeton community will gather to call our congresspeople and also at the rally to hold a candlelight vigil just to channel the energy to call for my husband's release.
So you've got support of Princeton, Yale, University of Washington. Why focus on support from academia?
Because my husband's imprisonment is enormous violation of academic freedom and human rights. What happened to my husband could happen to any academic traveling overseas. This is, I think, in terms of the freedom and also the safety of academics traveling everywhere, I think, I hope what happened to my husband won't happen to anyone in the future. And this is such a grief to the academia community.
You sound very frustrated.
Yes, indeed. My son is turning six in a few weeks, and he hasn't seen his dad for more than half of his young childhood. And my son, he literally felt that his dad won't come back. I'm just juggling this crisis management on a daily basis, and also be a single working mom and handling all the parenting challenges. I'm extremely frustrated, but I have to stay strong, because if I fall apart, who can help my husband and the family? So I have to stay strong and look ahead and just take one step at a time.
Huachu, the last time our reporter Ibi Caputo spoke with you, you told her about your husband's growing medical issues, both mental and physical, as he is detained in Evin prison in Tehran. What news do you have since then?
He has been almost in the same situation and is very worried. And he wants to come back to us. He wants to see me. He literally hasn't seen any photo from me in the past more than 2 years. And he is the American civil line who has been detained for the longest time ever since the hostage crisis in 1979.
Are you still able to communicate with him on the phone?
Yes, he can still call me on a daily basis. I think that is very important life for him. Yeah. He also wanted to speak to my son, but it's very difficult to bring a 5-year-old to form any conversation with him over the line that he cannot see his dad. It's very challenging, but they can speak with each other occasionally.
I mean, your son was what, 2 or 3 when your husband was detained in Iran? I mean, what do you tell your son about his father, your husband?
He just put into this situation in the fantasy of Dungeon Dragon or the castle, like fights, all of that fantasies. And he draws a lot of stories. He likes drawing and put his dad in that context. It's all about soldiers in chains and dungeon, like bursting fires. It's pretty violent, but it could be normal for any 5-year-old boy. But I can see he's processing a lot of difficult information on his young mind, and he's under a lot of tensions too. And these toes started burdening him.
Well, Huachu, thank you very much for being with us. It was really good to speak with you, and we wish you good luck.
Yeah, thank you, Marco.
Huachu, speaking with my colleague, Marco Werman. Her husband, Princeton scholar Shihua Wang, is an American citizen who's been imprisoned in Iran for more than 2 years now. Let's shift our focus now to India and Pakistan. Tensions have been rising between the two nuclear-armed neighbors recently. India blames Pakistan for 2 terrorist attacks in the disputed region of Kashmir. Nearly 50 Indian troops were killed in a suicide bombing last week, and 4 more in an attack today. Vipin Narang is a nuclear policy expert at MIT.
This is the worst terrorist attack in Kashmir in at least the last 2 decades. And I think, especially with Prime Minister Modi in India facing re-election in May, there was a lot of pressure on the Indian government to respond.
Now, a lot of our listeners are like, Kashmir, what the hell is it? Why is this such a sensitive spot? Take us there and what's going on?
So India and Pakistan were partitioned in 1947 as they were birthed from the British Empire. And the status of Kashmir, which is a bordering state, was always in question because the instrument of accession of the state of Kashmir to India was denied by Pakistan. And there have been four wars between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. And there is currently essentially a de facto border known as the line of control. And a lot of these attacks and a lot of the conflict between India and Pakistan on a day-to-day basis occurs across the line of control. And that is different from the established international border on the western side of India and the eastern side of Pakistan.
So getting back to these recent terror attacks, India is blaming Pakistan for the attacks. How come?
Interestingly enough, Jaish-e Mohammed immediately took credit for it, which made India's attribution problem very easy. Jaish-e Mohammed is a militant organization that both the United Nations and India and the United States claims is sponsored by the Pakistan military as a strategic asset of the state to attack India.
What makes this particular crisis different and possibly scarier and more lethal?
You know, the last time there was an attack against Indian security forces, Prime Minister Modi ordered what he called, and the Indians called, a so-called surgical strike, which was an insertion of special forces across the line of control in retaliation. He has now promised retaliation greater than that. There needs to be some sort of what I call retaliation theater to assuage domestic public opinion in India that's baying for blood right now. And Modi has promised a significant retaliation, and he'll have to deliver on that because he's facing a major re-election campaign in May. And the risk is there's a certain amount of retaliation that I think Pakistan would take without risking escalation. The question is how much. Visible missile strikes, for example, I think might force Pakistan to retaliate, and you get into this cycle where the conflict doesn't remain confined to the line of control, but spills over, potentially, over the international boundary and border. And I think that risk is very low, but you can imagine a scenario where Modi miscalculates and you can get off to the races really quickly.
Are you concerned enough in this current crisis to think, oh, there could be some sort of nuclear option being considered?
Not yet. I think right now there's a wide berth of potential retaliatory options, especially across the line of control. If India and Pakistan restrict themselves to exchanges across the line of control, then the risk of nuclear escalation is almost zero. But if things get going across the international border and India involves ground forces across the international border, then I think the risk rises really sharply. So for now, there's a lot of concern about escalation dynamics, and I share those concerns, but there's a long way between where we are today and potentially nuclear escalation. And both sides, you know, Pakistan will rattle the nuclear saber, as India likes to call it. But if the international border is crossed, then I think you have a really sharp rise of, you know, potentially conventional conflict that could escalate to nuclear use by Pakistan.
So I guess the lesson here is India has to do something and it doesn't have any good options.
That's exactly right.
Vipin Narang is a nuclear policy expert at MIT. He's been talking about the risks of a conflict between India and Pakistan. Thanks, Vipin.
Thank you, Carol. I appreciate it.
The president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, is notorious for making provocative statements and for his vicious war on drugs. His latest proposal? He wants to change the country's name. The World's Patrick Nguyen has that story.
The Philippines is named after a guy who never set foot in the Philippines. King Felipe II, also called King Philip, ruled Spain through much of the 16th century, a time when Spain was busy conquering civilizations all around the planet, including one archipelago in Asia that was home to many diverse societies and peoples. But the Spanish Empire said, nope, you're all subjects under one ruler now, King Felipe, and this whole island chain became the Philippines.
Philippines, because it was discovered by Magellan, using the money of King Philip.
That's President Duterte at a speech last week, bringing up not only King Philip, but Magellan, the first European explorer to ever reach the islands. Duterte says, we need to erase the influence of these idiots and rename the Philippines to the Republic of Maharlika.
The Republic of Maharlika, because Maharlika is a Malay word, and it means more of a concept of serenity and peace.
Maharlika is an old, old word, originating in Sanskrit and then used in the Malay language, which was spoken in the Asian tropics long before the Europeans came. I called a Filipina historian who specializes in the colonial era, and I asked for her gut reaction to this proposed name change.
I don't think everyday Filipinos think of their problems as being rooted in the colonial past.
Deirdre de la Cruz is an associate professor at the University of Michigan.
Honestly, most Filipinos have a lot more to worry about than being haunted by the ghost of King Philip.
Such as Duterte's war on drugs, which has killed, by some estimates, more than 20,000 people, piling problems on top of a nation already troubled by corruption, poverty, and fierce typhoons. Now, axing the name Philippines for the Republic of Maharlika, that idea was first pushed by Ferdinand Marcos, the U.S.-backed dictator who was ousted by his people back in the 1980s. But De La Cruz says Maharlika is often mistranslated.
The way that Duterte and Marcos are invoking Maharlika is wrong.
Duterte says it means serenity. Marcos said it referred to an ancient caste of royalty. Basically, anytime leaders want to evoke some pristine pre-colonial past, they often reach for this word, Maharlika.
But it's actually a term that's used to describe freemen, somebody who is not indentured. So the glorification of the word and its association with some grand kingdom is over-exaggerated.
There were really impressive societies on these islands, some with complex writing and trading routes that ran all the way to Japan and China. But De La Cruz says you can't look back to any one unspoiled kingdom that can now represent all the peoples of the Philippines, because there was no Philippines back then. It was just a lot of neighboring islands. It was the Spanish Empire that fused many, many peoples together under a common identity. So De La Cruz wonders, what's this proposal really about?
Why do authoritarian leaders have to reach into a pre-colonial past? Like, what's the why is there always this interest in creating this mythical past?
Her best guess?
Blaming a colonial tyranny of a distant past is a convenient way to absolve oneself of any accountability for the present.
Accountability is really not Duterte's thing. Those who condemn his policies, like lawmakers and journalists, they keep getting locked up. And as for what to call the country, well, Duterte's administration says Congress might just hold a referendum and let the people choose. For The World, Patrick Nguyen.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The World's Carolyn Beeler just hit the three-week mark on her expedition to Antarctica. She's been living on a ship alongside scientists who are studying the area around the Thwaites Glacier. It's to better understand how much that glacier might eventually contribute to global sea level rise. So, Carolyn, we're eager for an update on the science that's being conducted on board your ship. What's happening?
Yeah, so last week, two teams of scientists went to shore, actually, to three different sets of islands where they found seals to tag with sensors.
Ooh, were you able to go along with the teams?
I was, yeah. I got off the big ship and loaded into this little Zodiac boat. The weather was about negative 12, 13 degrees with wind chill, and we bounced through these waves and past some icebergs. And as we pulled up, the first thing you notice is these little cute Adelie penguins lining the ice. And the second thing you notice after you see them and hear them is their smell. Where there are penguins, there's penguin poop. But anyway, we were out on the island so that a group of scientists could attach sensors to seals. And before we went out, Lars Bouma from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland told me that the sensors track temperature, salinity, and depth when the seals dive and then transmit that data in real time each time they come back to the surface.
That means that in the winter, when it's minus 40 degrees, pitch dark, we get data from below the sea ice in front of the Thwaites Glacier, and we don't have to be here, so which is quite nice.
And so on this island we went to, I got to watch the process of how Lars and his team actually attached these sensors to the seals.
So how do they work?
How it typically works is that the researchers use a blow dart to anesthetize the seal, but in this particular case, they actually caught the seal, so they did a bit of a dance on this rocky beach for a minute or two until they were able to catch this female Weddell seal and then inject her with anesthesia. And then they epoxied, basically glued this sensor to the back of her head. But, you know, the seal didn't look like it was in pain at any point during the process. And one of the things that struck me as I watched this was how much respect Lars Bouma had for these animals.
look at us, how much stuff we have on. We are still freezing. And these guys live here. This is summer for them. They're still here in the winter. And, you know, they dive down to 500, 600 meters. They dive for half an hour. All what they do is extreme to us, and it's normal to them. So I think it's just amazing.
So how does this data that these seals will effectively gather, how does it fit into what scientists are trying to learn about the glacier that you're heading to?
So scientists think that the biggest driver of melting at Thwaites Glacier is these warmer ocean currents that in the past several decades have started pushing up onto the continental shelf that Antarctica sits on. It's thought that that warmer water is melting the underside of the floating front part of the glacier. But there's very little data about the water immediately in front of Thwaites. It's such a remote area and it's usually iced over. So scientists on this ship are using a bunch of different methods and tools to learn more about that water. And the seals are one of those tools in their toolbox.
Carolyn, I understand there's been a significant interruption in the research plan. What's happening?
Yeah, that's right. So on Friday morning, we were about to reach Thwaites Glacier when we did an about-face to head north for a medical evacuation. So we're steaming about 4 days north to the nearest research base where the patient will be able to get on a plane to Chile for some medical care.
Is the person going to be okay?
We don't know exactly what happened. No one on the ship's being told for privacy reasons, but we do know the patient's condition is stable. This kind of thing doesn't happen frequently, but with, you know, nearly 60 people on this ship for 2 months, it's not unprecedented. There are three EMTs on the ship, and there's a hospital room with some drugs and medical equipment, but standard operating procedure is that somebody needs to see a doctor in person or they need to get to a hospital, then procedure is to get them to a base where they can fly out as soon as possible. So that's what's happening here.
Carolyn, we've been getting a lot of questions from listeners for you, so we're going to throw some at you. We have two food-related questions. Ellen Green writes that she's a semi-professional chef with serious wanderlust. She's wondering how you get a job on a research vessel like the one you're on. And Paul Kep, who listens to KQED in San Francisco, he wants to know if it's possible to be a vegan or vegetarian on the ship.
Yeah, so I spoke to our chef, Julian Isaacs, who tells me he has 21 years as a professional chef. So sounds like Ellen might have to put in some time if she wants to go on an Antarctic research vessel as the chef. In terms of dietary restrictions, there are 5 vegetarians on the ship, so there are always lots of options for them. It's up to the chef whether or not they cater for a vegan diet. And on this ship, it's not an issue.
Have you seen where the food is stored on ship, and do they keep that under lock and key?
Yeah, I got a tour, actually. So there's a big refrigerated area and the dry goods area, so the room temperature stuff, is kept actually in a hold right at the front of the ship, so right in the bow. So it's actually the best place to go to listen to sea ice crashing against the hull of the ship.
Oh. Now, before you go, I have a final question from listener Megan Barton. She also listens on KQED in San Francisco. She's wondering if there are any artists on board who will be writing or creating films or artwork based on what happens on the ship.
There is, in fact, and she's actually my cabin mate. The National Science Foundation, which runs the U.S. Antarctic Program, has an Antarctic Artist and Writer in Residence program. And on this trip, Elizabeth Rush is the writer in residence, and she plans to write a book about the trip in the coming years.
The World's Carolyn Beeler aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer. If you have a question for Carolyn about this research expedition to the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica, drop her a line. The email address is myworld@theworld.org. That's myworld@theworld.org. If you want to see photos from the expedition, including some of those seals with the devices on their foreheads, go to our Instagram. We're at @PRI the world. And finally today, a preview for some hard-to-get stories we're going to have for you starting tomorrow.
2 years ago, I started applying to get a journalist visa.
This week, the world's Shirin Jafari takes us to a country that's trying to put on a new face.
This was way before the, you know, Khashoggi story. This was way before the lifting of the driving ban.
Shirin goes to Saudi Arabia and speaks with people ready for change.
Honestly, I never, not in 1,000 years, imagined that one day it would be possible for me to get behind the wheel and drive myself home.
But some Saudis are not ready for change.
I have driver. I don't look for parking. I don't clean my car. I don't replace petrol.
Shirin asks a lot of questions.
I look around. The minder is a few feet away. I mumble, what do you think about what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
To whom?
To Khashoggi.
Why you are talking about Khashoggi?
A troubled kingdom. What the world's Shirin Jafari discovered in Saudi Arabia. That's on the show beginning tomorrow. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us.